Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 276 of Her, the podcast where you're going to hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today her autonomic nervous system. Scratch your head. That's right. I'm going to really open your eyes here to a condition that you need to know about. It's going to be a terrific episode. Before we begin, just know that it's made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. Okie dokie. Now, here's your first official reminder to click onto iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show. You know why? Because I love hearing from you. Your feedback is absolutely golden. So here's your first reminder. I'm going to give you another one at the end of the episode because I want to hear from you. Just love, love, love to hear from you. All right. It's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
So, you know, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago about what's going on with a lot of the people who've gotten COVID-19 and are basically in a recovery phase. And many of them, as it turns out, have an issue with something that you may not have even heard of before, and that is called dysautonomia. Up to 15% of them, actually. So what's that all about? I did a little bit of research and actually reached out to the investigator who was working with these wonderful patients over at Mount Sinai, New York. And lo and behold, stumbled upon this wonderful organization, the Dysautonomia International Organization. This group is led by Lauren Stiles, who is a founder, and she is our wonderful expert for all things dysautonomia for this episode. Lauren Stiles holds a BA in Earth and Space Science with a minor in Marine Science from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. After graduating with honors from Pace University's School of Law, she joined a private practice where she focused on environmental law and land use planning. She served in leadership positions on several government councils, nonprofit boards, and professional associations. She sustained a severe head injury at the age of 31, which left her bedridden for 2 years with no clear diagnosis and no effective treatment. She was eventually diagnosed with an autonomic nervous system disorder. Hoping to reduce diagnostic delays, improve access to care, and deliver more effective treatments to over 70 million people all around the world living with autonomic disorders, Lauren then founded the Dysautonomia International in 2012. Lauren, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I might have to take you everywhere, take you with me everywhere to give that kind of introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, people love my intros. They actually live for them, and they just can't wait to be back on the podcast.
Yeah.
They just want to hear about themselves. I just love doing that. But you know something? You took the time and the effort to be able to be with us and to enlighten us about what this is all about. So we're going to take a couple steps back. Tell us all about dysautonomia and tell us what happened to you.
Sure. So dysautonomia is the overall like umbrella term that we use to describe all of the different autonomic nervous system disorders. So if you think of it like cancer describes many different types of cancer fall under that umbrella. So there's many different types of dysautonomia. Some of them are very rare. Some of them are very common. Most of them you've probably never heard of because this is just not something that has sort of made its way into the public vocabulary. But we're working on that, and thanks to your help, we'll reach an even bigger audience. So your autonomic nervous system, if you remember back to some high school biology, you have your fight or flight branch of your autonomic nervous system, and you have your rest and digest branch. So fight or flight is the part of the nervous system that helps you run away from a scary bear that's about to attack you. You know, gives you that energy boost, that adrenaline rush. It's the part of your nervous system that gets fired off right before you have to give a big speech and you get nervous, you get the butterflies in your tummy. That's the fight or flight branch. That's a sympathetic nervous system. It's part of the autonomic nervous system. Then the rest and digest branch is the parasympathetic nervous system, and that helps you sleep. It helps you digest your food. It's sort of the chillaxin part of the nervous system.
And I like it.
Yeah, it's the good part. Well, they're both important, right? But the so quite often, different types of dysautonomia can have problems with the different branches of the different types of problems. But the most common thing you would see is somebody who has too much sympathetic nervous system activity. So that's too much fight or flight. And then not enough parasympathetic nervous system activity. So not enough of that rest and digest activity. And that can present with symptoms like abnormal blood pressure, tachycardia, chest pain, shortness of breath, feeling very dizzy and lightheaded when you stand up. Sometimes, if it's bad enough, fainting. And so this dysautonomia comes in this very big spectrum, from very mild, where people would never even think to go to the doctor for it because it's just sort of a mild annoyance, all the way up to some forms of dysautonomia being fatal. And most people fall somewhere in the middle of that, where they have a dysautonomia that is debilitating but not fatal. And so what do we do for these patients? How do we diagnose them? How do we get them better treatment? And how do we fund the research that finds better treatments? Because unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot of enough research on these disorders to find effective treatments for most of them. So that's what our organization is all about. We formed in 2012 by with patients and caregivers and doctors who wanted to advance this field of research forward to find answers for these patients. Anyone who's ever lived with an autonomic disorder can tell you that they look totally normal on the outside. They usually don't have any visible appearance of disability, but they have a lot of things that they can no longer do or have real difficulty doing because their illness can be so debilitating.
Well, so give us an example of what it's like to live with a dysautonomia. Now, clearly, there's a spectrum of manifestations, but, you know, kind of do a little bit of a laundry list. What goes on?
Sure, sure. So for me, I'll give you my example. I had this very bad snowboarding concussion and injury, and within 2 days, I could no longer stand up. And it wasn't because my leg muscles stopped working, but it was because I could not regulate my heart rate and blood pressure anymore. And so every time I stood up, my blood pressure would drop to the bottom of the ocean and my heart rate would skyrocket. And I wasn't getting enough blood flow to my heart or my brain. So eventually I would pass out from not having enough oxygen, for, you know, freshly oxygenated blood making it up to my brain. And so imagine for 2 years of your life not being able to stand up. I mean, I could not even stand up to walk to the bathroom or to get a glass of water from the kitchen. I was 31 and married, and my mom had to move in and take care of me. I couldn't even do the most basic life chores. It's bad enough to have that symptom profile, but then to not know what's causing it, to have doctors, you know, I grew up, I never really had severe illness, so I had asthma as a kid, you know. You have an asthma attack, you go to the doctor, they say your kid has asthma, and they give you treatment, and you can get on with your life because you know what it is, you have a treatment plan, you have a game plan to live. When you have an undiagnosed autonomic disorder, it's like you're alive, but you're not really living a life. You're very, very sick, and not so many doctors don't know what this is. So patients have very lengthy misdiagnosis periods. The average, when we first started checking, studying the diagnostic delays, is that the average POTS patient, which is one of the forms of dysautonomia, had a diagnostic delay of about 6 or 7 years. And now that's reduced to about 4 years, but because we're increasing the awareness by educating clinicians and patients and the public. But imagine being bedridden for 6 or 7 years because nobody knew what was wrong with you.
And so I want to make sure people know what POTS is. It's postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
Right.
So as you just mentioned, just getting up, dropped your
So people
blood pressure.
Have a problem with their heart rate increase on standing.
Yes.
And their heart can go way too fast. But they have other symptoms. Your autonomic nervous system regulates your heart rate and your blood pressure, but it also regulates your GI motility. So when you eat a cheeseburger, you don't have to think about it. The digestion part. Your body does that for you through your autonomic nervous system. So when your autonomic nervous system and your GI tract isn't working, you have trouble moving food through your GI tract. So people can have dramatic weight loss or severe nausea, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, and if you're not eating because you feel so unwell each time you eat, then you develop all kinds of other problems like vitamin deficiencies and whatnot. So the GI tract is a big part of autonomic disorders. Patients also have temperature dysregulation problems because the autonomic nervous system regulates your sweat glands. And if you're not sweating properly in all or certain parts of your body, you can have a real difficult time with temperature changes or, high and low temperatures. Bladder function is also controlled by the autonomic nervous system. This tends to only happen in more severe autonomic disorders where people will lose part or all of their bladder function.
When I spoke with Dr. Petrino, who is the senior investigator of this very innovative and cutting-edge examination of the post-COVIDs who have dysautonomia, he had a nice little laundry list of what he was actually noting, so much of what you've already noted. Another thing he saw was that almost half of them had an issue with thermoregulation. In other words, temperature control.
Yes.
What have you noticed among yours?
So I've actually spoken with Dr. Petrino, I'm working on a similar study. We're working on a study. Dysautonomia International is working on a study with Stanford University's Autonomic Lab to develop a large cohort international online survey for any COVID patient to take the survey to tell us what their symptom profiles are over time. Because one of the things we need to do is, there's an acceptance now by most doctors that there's a subset of patients that are having these long-term symptoms. But many patients with that problem in COVID are just like regular dysautonomia patients from, not from COVID. They're being misdiagnosed. They're being told it's not real. The doctor doesn't recognize the symptom pattern. So they're kind of going through the same thing that dysautonomia patients go through. But there's a lot of things happening in COVID that are beyond just dysautonomia. There's definitely some patients with sensory and motor problems. There's a lot of hair loss happening. So we kind of recognize that there's this problem, but we really need to be careful how we define it and study it, and we shouldn't just sort of assume everything's a dysautonomia. So I actually gave a webinar with Dr. Miglis from the Stanford Autonomic Lab just a week or two ago, explaining to the COVID patient community what dysautonomia is, how it's diagnosed, how it's generally treated, from a high-level sense. And then also explaining some important stuff about COVID. We don't want every COVID patient that has some long-term symptoms. And how do you define long-term? That's a question, too. Is it a month? Is it 3 months? I think that has to be studied, and there's going to eventually have to be some consensus on what's post-viral COVID and what's active viral COVID. But in any case, we don't want to just assume that everyone with long-term symptoms has dysautonomia. There are specific diagnostic testing for it, specific types of dysautonomia that should be diagnosed. You don't really want to get a generic dysautonomia diagnosis. It's not really sort of like being told you have infection without being told what kind. And we also want to make sure that they don't have some of the serious underlying complications that COVID can cause, which can cause similar symptoms. So, for example, in rare cases, COVID can cause a myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle, pericarditis, inflammation of the heart lining, blood clots in the lungs. And those can all cause symptoms like lightheadedness and dizziness and shortness of breath and irregular heart rate and blood pressure. So I want to caution COVID patients that are listening, not to be terrified that you have these really severe complications, but probably don't just assume it's dysautonomia. Definitely try to talk to a doctor before you initiate a treatment aimed at treating a dysautonomia. You want to make sure that it's not something more severe. And I'm not saying dysautonomia is not severe, but it's the way that you would treat myocarditis from COVID is very different than the way you would treat a post-viral dysautonomia. So that's my...
And again, you're going to be working with the Stanford team with a is that a global survey?
Yeah, so we're we're just a few days away from having our ethics approval from the university where we can start recruiting, but we plan to have an international online survey. It's an English language survey, and open to anyone who had confirmed COVID, who thinks they had COVID, because we can, you know, we know that a lot of people didn't have access to testing when they thought they had it. And so we're serving everyone, and then we'll kind of break down the data by confirmed and not confirmed to sort of see if it's any different. But open to everyone, and it's just asking about symptoms, you know, the patient experience pretty much. And then there'll hopefully be a clinical follow-up at Stanford of people who live in the San Francisco Bay Area will be invited to come in and have more detailed in-person clinical testing if they feel safe going to do that. And we've actually... We're communicating because some of the journal articles coming out on this are mentioning dysautonomia. We're getting contacted by a lot of researchers from other countries, and we just had a conversation yesterday with a group of researchers from Sweden who have 2,000 post-COVID patients that they are now studying, and they're looking at, you know, they're hopefully going to be looking at whether these patients have a dysautonomia and sort of other manifestations of this. And also importantly, if there is a dysautonomia present, you know, what was the cause of it, or what is the cause of it? Because there might be a different treatment approach if you could figure out the actual mechanism. So something important to mention in the context of a post-viral illness is deconditioning. So a lot of people, and I can tell you myself, when people said this to me when I first was sick, they said, oh, you're just deconditioned. And I would get super annoyed. I'd be like, I'm an athlete. I'm super healthy. I was on a snowboarding trip when I got sick, you know. But it's very easy to become deconditioned. Just in, you know, 1 or 2 days laying in bed, you can lose like 5% of your cardiac efficiency, you know. And if you've been in bed for a week, you know, suddenly you've gotten yourself pretty deconditioned, and it's not the patient's fault. It's natural. It's what happens when we have a bad viral infection. Our body needs to rest, so we rest, but that rest can lead to deconditioning, and deconditioning can cause almost all of the same symptoms as dysautonomia. It can cause all the lightheadedness and the dizziness and the shortness of breath and fainting sensations, you know. So, and often, if you have a dysautonomia, if your blood pressure and heart rate is not regulating properly, you're going to tend to rest more. You know, you're not going to probably go run a marathon if your blood pressure is super low. So you tend to unintentionally become deconditioned if you have a dysautonomia. So then it becomes hard to figure out what's what. Is this an autonomic nerve disorder, or is this a deconditioning problem? And sometimes, and maybe often, it's both. So part of the rehab that Dr. Petrino is doing at Mount Sinai includes, you know, carefully sort of tailoring an exercise plan for patients, making sure they don't have, you know, an underlying heart problem or something like that from COVID, but making sure that we're treating any deconditioning that might be contributing to the long-term syndrome. It certainly isn't the full picture, but it's a natural part of any post-viral illness. You know, what do we all do when we get a bad flu? We lay in bed for a few days. So this is something that I think it's hard for patients to hear this because it sounds dismissive, but it's not at all. I'm not dismissive about this. I'm a patient who had to go through my own reconditioning exercises, and it was not fun. trying to do exercise when you already feel so sick is very hard. And people.
Yes, and well, the other thing that I think you bring up, which is extremely important, is that, you know, how well are my brethren out there in the medical community really trained to be able to do the full diagnostics on this and to truly understand what's going on? Because as you noted, it can be very fuzzy and you're not quite sure, you know, which way is up. So I think that there's a whole issue of training and education. And I noticed that in what you do with the Dysautonomia, you know, International Organization, is you do physician education, and that this is, you know, offered as continuing medical education courses on autonomic disorders. Do you see that there's been some improvement in spreading the word to the medical community to be able to enhance the ability to diagnose more appropriately?
Yeah. So I don't see that improved diagnostic skills collectively yet, but I do see more even just having researchers who aren't necessarily the autonomic gurus, you know, having infectious disease doctors or pulmonologists and others starting to write about this in journal articles, just getting that conversation going has more doctors thinking about this. It is my hope that for the sake of COVID patients who are dealing with this and for the sake of other dysautonomia patients who don't have it as a result of COVID, that maybe this is a wake-up call for medicine, that we need to do a better job of training doctors on this. And as a patient, it's extremely frustrating when you are so sick and you see a doctor and they don't know how to help you, or they you know, often, I wouldn't say always, but often these patients will get blamed. Oh, this is all in your head. You know, you just don't want to go back to work or something like that. It's so frustrating. But I try to tell patients to try to have an understanding that your doctor probably never received training on autonomic disorders. I'm a professor at Stony Brook at a medical school. I lecture at medical schools all over the country. I've met really senior people in neurology who are like, oh, I never got a lecture on this when I was going through my training. So it's collectively this medical system, that education system that we have, is not teaching doctors about autonomic disorders. So it's not surprising that COVID patients who might have an autonomic problem are kind of getting sidelined when they go to get care. I'm hoping that this will be one reason why we do a better job of that. And we're actually, we host a physician education course as part of our annual conference every year. And our conference usually in person, but this year it's virtual due to COVID. So we're having our annual conference in October, and we're going to have physician education lectures on autonomic disorders meant for doctors interested in learning more, how to diagnose this. And, you know, sometimes people do need the formal autonomic testing where they go to a major autonomic lab, but there are not a lot of them. So if it was 15% of COVID patients that are going to end up with an autonomic problem, there is no way that the handful of autonomic labs that exist in the U.S. or even around the world could handle that volume of people. They could barely handle the volume of existing dysautonomia patients. So there are other types of testing that any clinician can do. For example, orthostatic vitals. I'm sure you've done this as an MD, where you take someone's heart rate and blood pressure laying down for a few minutes, then you have them stand up for a few minutes and you retake it. Pretty much any doctor's office can do this. And that is sometimes called a poor man's tilt test. A tilt test is they strap you to a table and tilt you upright and measure your vitals very precisely. But when that's not available, a poor man's tilt test is often used as a substitute. And so that's something we want more doctors to be thinking about in their COVID patients, especially if they're reporting lightheadedness or tachycardia or dizziness. You know, GI doctors play a role. Sometimes the GI motility doctors have a pretty good understanding of autonomics, because patients with GI motility disorders usually have an autonomic problem. So they do, you know, GI motility testing can be helpful. I'm not sure that this is that's a really big thing in the long-term COVID patients yet. I haven't seen too much on that. But
well, you know, I think it's important also for people to understand that the whole issue of dysautonomia, you know, really spans a spectrum of causes and etiologies in the beginning. It could be anything from acute and reversible, like Guillain-Barré syndrome. It can be chronic and progressive. Now, I bet you didn't know. This is one of those bet you didn't knows. I love doing this with my wonderful Her podcast listeners. But it can also be associated with diabetes and alcoholism. And a lot of people don't know that either. Also, neurological diseases such as Parkinson's can also do this. And, you know, I think really at the end of the day, it's so terribly important to ask the right questions and to realize that you need to be able to work with people who are enlightened about this. And I think it's one of those situations where you want to, you know, hope to heaven that the provider you're working with is enlightened. And you know something? It's a two-way street. As a physician, I love it when people come to me and say, hey, Dr. Peak, read this. This is really cool. Do you know about this? And at which point in time, I'll do my due diligence, to say the least. But, you know, I'd like to turn the page over here to treatment. What in heaven's name do you do if you have something like, say, for instance, POTS, the postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which is a subset of dysautonomia? What are the treatments? How did you learn to live with this?
So for people with POTS, there's sort of, three approaches to treatment. There's the non-pharmacological treatment, which is stuff you can do it yourself at home. I mean, you should see a doctor and get advised on what to do, but non-pharmacological treatments like increasing your oral salt and fluid intake, assuming you don't have a kidney problem or a major cardiac problem, you know, increasing your salt is the rest of society is trying to reduce their salt, but people with POTS are told to have 8 to 10 grams of salt per day. And 2 to 3 liters of water or fluids, hydrating fluids per day. Alcohol and coffee and soda, you know, caffeinated soda doesn't count as hydrating because, well, it is a little hydrating, but it tends to not be as effective as, you know, something like water or coconut milk or sports drinks. If you are drinking sports drinks, try not to drink too much sugar because that can contribute to autonomic problems down the road, especially if you develop diabetes. So salt, increasing salt and fluid intake. Some patients use medical compression garments, like compression stockings or abdominal compression, because part of the problem in POTS is that the blood is pooling in the lower half of the body and not getting up to the heart and brain. So you sort of squeeze your legs and your tummy. You help push the blood back up. Starting a very slow and gradual recumbent exercise program where you start laying down so that you're not triggering your lightheadedness and tachycardia standing, starting an exercise program reclined, things like swimming, recumbent rowing, recumbent bicycling. These can be done. Everyone does them at their own pace. And, you know, some people say exercise is amazing. Other people say this just makes me feel so much worse. It's very individualized. But we also have a lot of patients who will experiment. We don't really have any clinical guidance on what the right dietary approach is to this, but a lot of patients will report feeling somewhat better on an anti-inflammatory diet or avoiding a lot of processed foods and carbs. That's kind of anecdotal, you know, but it can't hurt you to eat healthy, so give it a try.
I know. Seriously, all these things sound like something outside of the salt and all the rest of it. Really sounds like something you should be doing anyway.
Right. But it becomes extra important when you have a... one of the things in POTS is that patients develop low blood volume. So regular exercise can increase your blood volume. So that's why exercise is sort of pushed on the POTS patients so much, because we know that regular exercise increases blood volume, and that is one of the problems we're trying to treat in POTS. You know, making sure you have good sleep. Your autonomic nervous system is very sensitive to your sleep habits. So if you're staying up way late and on the iPhone till 3 a.m. and then going to sleep and waking up at 8 a.m. for work, your autonomic nervous system is going to be pretty cranky the next day. So, you know, trying to get good sleep, which can be hard if you have chronic pain or symptoms as you're trying to sleep. Then there's a whole bunch of medication-type treatments, more commonly things like beta blockers to slow down that too-fast heart rate, or ivabradine, which is a drug that slows down your heart rate without dropping your blood pressure. Mestinon is sometimes used. This is a drug that stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system. Drugs like midodrine, which compress the blood, squeeze the blood vessels a little bit more for you to get that blood flowing upwards to your heart and brain. There's a whole bunch of different pharmacological agents used, and not every patient needs everything. You know, some people mostly have a problem with their GI motility. So maybe they, if your GI motility is very slow, we might give you Mestinon. If your GI motility is very fast, we probably wouldn't give you Mestinon because it makes it go faster. So there's, you know, there's pharmacological agents. It's hard to explain it because there's so many different things used, because the autonomic nervous system, really, it regulates every organ. So you could have problems in different systems and organs, and that's how you tailor the treatment approach. Like, what symptoms are most troubling for this patient?
I love it. I love it. This has really, really been amazingly interesting to me, and a real eye-opener, again, at multiple levels. Let me ask you one last question. Did you ever have problems with temperature regulation yourself?
I did, yeah, when I was very sick. So not to divert onto a side note as we're wrapping up here, but so my own case was post-concussive onset, but it ended up being an autoimmune disease. And so an autoimmune disease causing an autonomic nervous system disorder. It's a little complicated, but they put me on immunotherapy, and my autoimmune disease being treated helped my autonomic nervous system heal. And I had small fiber neuropathy, which a lot of patients with dysautonomia will have. And my small fiber nerves actually grew back after I went on immunotherapy. So small fiber nerves are a lot easier to grow back than other types of nerves. Once they're in healthy conditions, you know, they tend to grow back on their own. So I was very lucky that I got the right treatment, and I got mostly better. I still have symptoms every day, but I'm doing okay. And so part of the research that we're very interested in, especially with post-viral onset dysautonomias, you know, is there an immunological problem here that we can treat with existing immunotherapies or soon to be developed immunotherapies? And I think we're going to see that kind of research in the COVID population for sure. And we're already doing that type of research in POTS.
I love it. I absolutely love it. You know, it wasn't a sidebar. I think it's really important for people to understand what you lived with. You know, I mean, you're a human being, and this also helps impassion you, you know, as you push forth with all of the work that you're doing, which is very comprehensive with the Dysautonomia International Organization. And kudos to you, Lauren, for, you know, taking what happened to you and running with it, discovering that there was this gap in knowledge, let alone what was going on with diagnostics and treatment out there, and then trying to address this with multiple platforms, with everything from activism to education. So, you know, congrats to you and your whole team for doing this.
It's definitely a team effort. There's so many people who have this stuff, and you know, we have like more volunteers than we know what to do with. There's so many people that have this that want to change the system and make it better for the next patient, and that's what everyone on our team is all about. We're trying to take a scientific and professional approach to sort of flipping the system upside down and trying to educate doctors, fund the research that needs to happen, get heard in the halls of government to get the resources these types of patients need. And it's not an overnight fix. You know, it's been years of this area of medicine kind of being neglected and ignored. I had one doctor tell me that autonomic neurology is the Cinderella stepchild of neurology, like kind of living up in the attic. And so we're trying to get Cinderella in her ball gown and get her to come downstairs to the party, you know?
I know. Well, I think you're doing a heck of a job. Everyone out there in the Her Podcast land, run on over to Lauren's website. And this is the website of the organization. It's called dysautonomiainternational.org, dysautonomiainternational.org. To learn more about this and to enlighten yourself. And hey, if you're a medical provider out there, listen up. You should know. You need to know. Lauren, I want to thank you so much for being on the Her Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And everyone out there, take a moment now, run on over to iTunes, rate and review the show, and Have you been enlightened? I want to hear from you. Why? Because I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. Hey, listen, stay safe and stay well.